Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It's April the 2nd. This is Shmuel, but rather than continuing with the next perek, we are going to be discussing Pesach. So, we know that the night of the Seder, we do a lot of different things that are symbolic. They're symbolic of many different things. Of course, we have the we say in doing the Seder Pesach, Matzah, Maror. We know that you've got to hold up the Matzah and hold up the Maror or point to them. And we do many things that are symbolic. Now, these symbolic things, many of them are actually mitzvos, whether they're mitzvos in the Torah itself or they are mitzvos from the Rabbanan, from the sages, but they are requirements that we do. So, eating the matzah is a Torah law. Eating the maror in the time of the Beis HaMikdash is a Torah law. Today, it's a rabbinic law. Drinking the four cups is a rabbinic law. Saying Hallel is a Torah law. So we have a lot of different things. But then we have different symbolic items that are neither Torah nor rabbinic in nature. Like, for instance, karpas. When we dip the vegetable in salt water, that is part of the Seder. We need to do it, but it's neither a Torah nor a rabbinic law. It's not a commandment. It is the way that the sages set up that we do the Seder. If one doesn't do that, they haven't violated any kind of law, but it's appropriate to do it. Of course, telling the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, of the Exodus, that is a Torah law that we do on the night of the Seder. Afikomen is meant to replace the Pesach sacrifice was a Torah law, which we can't do today. The Afikomen replaces that, and we do that in its stead. That appears to be a rabbinic replacement for the Torah law of the Karban Pesach. So we do many different things. Now, the way that the symbolism works in the Seder night is that we do many things that are symbolic of slavery. That would be the Maror, particularly. And we do many more things that are symbolic of freedom. Of Chayrus, of freedom. So what are the things that we do that are symbolic of Chayrus on the Seder night?
Lean.
Okay, we recline. Women are not required to recline, but you can if you wish. But reclining is considered to be a sign of freedom. What else?
Well, when you
bring
the cup, Korban Pesach, that we don't break bones.
Okay, good, good. What did you
say? Pouring the cups to each other.
Okay, good. Okay, so let's take each one separately. So we don't break bones. We don't eat the Korban Pesach today, but if we had a Korban Pesach, there is a mitzvah not to break a bone. The Sefer HaChinuch writes that the reason why we don't break bones, or I should say, an understanding as to why we don't break bones, we don't do it because the Torah says so. But the deeper understanding is because a person who is wealthy and is not desperate for their next meal is not trying to eat every morsel of edible food on the bone. And when you're trying to get to every little morsel, then you break the bone because you're trying to get to everything, the marrow and every little thing you can get to. If you don't need to worry about that, so you eat whatever you eat, and whatever you don't, you're not so particular about getting to every little piece. So he says that's a sign of freedom, a sign of wealth, a sign of comfort. To not need to go break the bones, right? There is a minhag. It's a custom not to pour one's own cup of wine, but rather to have someone else pour for you, as someone who is in a position of luxury doesn't do their own work. They have someone serving them who pours for them.
How
do
we dip?
We dip. Dipping appears to also be a form of freedom, even though one of the things that we dip is the maror, so it's a little bit. The four cups in and of itself is for freedom, is for chayrus, and the four cups, just drinking wine in general, is a sign of freedom, and also they are keneged, they correspond to the four languages of geula, of redemption, those four languages that Hashem uses when he tells Moshe he's going to take us out of Egypt. So we have those four cups.
And then there's Vayvesi, right?
Yeah. So what else do we do as a sign of chirus, of freedom?
Saying halal.
Okay, halal could be also. That's the praise Hashem. One of the things that we do is that it's appropriate for a person to put out their most expensive items at the Pesach Seder. Now, you can't do it if your items are chametz items. But if they're not chametz items, then it's appropriate to put out your most expensive silver, your most expensive china, whatever it is that you have, where normally we would not put everything out on the table. And the reason why we normally wouldn't is because of the Churban HaBayis, because of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So it's not appropriate to put out all of our finery a normal day. But the Pesach Seder, it's appropriate to act as if we are in total freedom, in total luxury, total relaxation and comfort, and we put out our best. That is the appropriate thing to do with the Pesach Seder.
This is the night of guarding, that we can leave the doors open, and
yeah,
we don't have fear of.
We don't have fear, so leave the door open. That's right. The door open, we open the door, when we pour the fifth cup, we open the door, and also the minhag is not to lock the door on the night of Pesach. When you go to sleep, to leave the door unlocked. If you're uncomfortable doing that, it is appropriate to at least lock it less. Meaning, if you normally put three locks on the door, only lock two of them on Pesach night. It's appropriate to reduce the amount that you do, because we don't look at Pesach as being a night of a regular night. It's considered like a daytime. So you treat it as if it's daylight. And just like during the day, you wouldn't lock all the locks to your house. So too, Pesach night, we don't either. Now, what's interesting over here is that although the language that is used is chirus, which is freedom, but the way that we act at the Pesach Seder, I think that we would not be a stretch for us to say that it is connected heavily to Malchus, to royalty. The way that we act in a royal manner. Someone else is going to pour my cup. I'm going to drink four cups of wine. I'm going to recline as I drink in luxury. I don't need to sit up straight at the table. There's a certain sense of, you know, of wealth, of having. Even a person who doesn't have, who God forbid is strapped for money, has to try their best to get four cups of wine. That's a very important mitzvah to say, because everybody has to act in some manner like a free, and free we are equating here with comfort, as a comfortable person. That I don't need to worry about where my next meal is coming from. I don't have to break the bones. And I have the four cups of wine. I recline. Someone else pours for me, as if I have waiters waiting upon me. Right. So that is the way that we act at the Pesach Seder. The mitzvah of reclining is a fascinating one. As I said before, women do not have to recline, but can if you wish. Men are required to recline. If a man drinks one of the four cups or eats the matzah without reclining, according to many authorities, they have not fulfilled the mitzvah and have to do it again. That's how important it is for men to recline when they drink the four cups and have the matzah at the Pesach Seder.
Yeah, but what's the level of the recline, though? Is it just a
little bit? A little bit is fine.
Because I see people sit on the couch and actually go to
sleep. Yeah, you could do that. Yeah. You could do that. In their day, they used to eat on couches.
Yeah, sure.
They used to eat on couches. It's very uncomfortable to recline on a regular chair the way we have it mm-hmm. today. What they used to have is, if you can picture a couch, a low couch. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of stretched down on the couch against the corner of the couch over here, so you're kind of like, you know, like that. And the table actually comes up to here.
Oh, wow.
You know, you're like, you're not gonna, you know, you're just, you know.
And the young children, all
around you. Yeah, that's what it was. It was a very comfortable way to eat. Not all the way down, because then you can't eat. That's dangerous. Or, you know, you're mostly up, but you're reclining. It's very comfortable way to eat. So, but the halacha is that if a man is at a seder, and at that seder there is someone that who has authority, then the man is required not to recline. Meaning that if a son is at his father's table, so there we say the son does recline. But the reason we say the son reclines in such a situation is because we presume that the father is permitting the Son to recline. But we do need the Father's permission. We just presume the Father gives permission. If a man is at his Rebbe's table, then he's not allowed to recline unless his Rebbe gives him permission. So let's think about that for a moment. A man is required to recline. Why is he required to recline? In order to symbolize freedom, comfort, luxury. That's the point. But if his Rebbe is at the table and his Rebbe does not explicitly give him permission to recline, not only is he not required to recline, he's not allowed to recline. He must sit up straight and eat. So what happens to the whole notion of showing freedom, of showing chairus? What happens to the whole notion of showing comfort? If I'm not allowed to recline in the presence of my Rebbe because it's disrespectful, so maybe the law should be that I can't have a Seder with my Rebbe. Maybe that should be the law. Right? Maybe that should be in order to avoid that problem. Because how can I fulfill my obligation? If Chazal said, recline because that's the way you show freedom, then if this doesn't fit with having your Rebbe there, then don't be with your Rebbe. But to say that you can't recline because your Rebbe is, you have to show respect for your Rebbe, then doesn't that counteract the whole point of the Seder? Or maybe Chazal should say that when it comes to reclining, you don't show respect to your Rebbe. It's more important to engage in an act of freedom and comfort than it is to show respect to your Rebbe. Why don't we say that? But we don't. We don't say that. So that's a curiosity. Why should it be that somehow this important mitzvah, and I want to emphasize how important it is, I said to you before, if a man doesn't recline when he's supposed to, according to many authorities, he's got to do it over again. If I drink a cup of wine and I don't recline and I'm not in front of my Rebbe, according to many authorities, I got to drink another cup. If I eat the afikomen without reclining, according to many authorities, I got to eat another kezias of matzah for afikomen. So you see how critical it is. It's not just a nice thing to do. It's critical for a man to recline. Yet if his Rebbe is there, unless his Rebbe gives him explicit permission to recline, he does not recline in deference to his Rebbe. Well, what do you mean? But then you're not doing the mitzvah. Would we say that, because my Rebbe is here, therefore I should not sit on the floor on Tisha B'Av because it's in front of my Rebbe, it's not respectful to be sitting on the mitzvah. We don't do that. You got to keep the mitzvah. You do whatever the mitzvah is. You know, whatever the mitzvah is, you have to do. It doesn't matter if your Rebbe is there. Dancing on Simchas Torah, in front of the Torah, where you act dancing in a manner like we're going to learn it, Mitzvah Hashem, soon with David in Shmuel Beis, where he's Mefazeg Zumacharker, he dances in a wild way in front of Hashem. And he says, that's the way you're supposed to in front of Hashem. We'll have to discuss that. Do we say, but if your Rebbe is there, you don't do it? Right? That's the mitzvah. You know, right? So it is a curiosity why over here Chazal said that if your Rebbe is there, then don't recline and you still fulfill the mitzvah. They could have said that, okay, just don't do the mitzvah. Your Rebbe is there, so you can't eat the matzah, you can't drink the wine. That's not what they said. Drink it, eat it, and don't recline and you'll fulfill your mitzvah. But if he's not there, if the Rebbe's not there, then you must recline. Mm-hmm. That's a funny thing. So it would seem to be almost inescapable that the same symbolism that takes place when a man reclines when his Rebbe is not there is taking place when he doesn't recline when his Rebbe is there. You hear what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I'm suggesting to you that when his Rebbe is sitting at the table and he does not recline, he is actually engaging in the same symbolism that he engages in when he reclines when his Rebbe is not there in their normal conditions. And it's not that when his Rebbe is there, he can't do it in the proper way. No. The proper way becomes doing it, sitting up straight. And that is a sign of freedom. Now, how could that be? How could it be that the same symbolism that's accomplished, I showed you, right? The same symbolism that's accomplished, right? The same symbolism that's accomplished when his Rebbe is not there is accomplished when his Rebbe is there. It would seem diametrically opposed. Mm-hmm. This is absolutely the opposite of that. Right? So, but how could it be? How would it be that it's the exact same thing?
That we are showing that we have the freedom to learn Torah.
Okay, okay.
Because that was an important freedom that was taken away from us, that the Rebbeim were not allowed to teach and we were not allowed to learn.
Okay, okay, that's good. That's good. That would be an allusion to what the Gemara says, that the term chairus, which means freedom, also, using different vowels, can be read charus, which means engraved. The Torah says that the letters on the luchos, on the tablets, were charus al haluchos. They were engraved on the luchos. The Gemara says, al tikri charus, don't read it engraved, el chairus, rather free. What does that teach us? Why the double meaning? So the Gemara says, "She'ein lecha ben chorin." There's no one who is free. Elamisha osik ba Torah. Only if you study Torah. If you're involved in Torah, you become free. Now, there are different explanations said about that, but perhaps the most well-known explanation about that is that as long as we're not involved in Torah study, then we are actually slaves to ourselves. We're slaves to our ego. We're slaves to our jealousy. We're slaves to our desires and passions, and we don't have any control over ourselves. Once we are involved in Torah, then we become in control. We are now free to do really as we please. Whereas what the world considers to be free to do as you please is not really free to do as you please. It's free to be a slave to your inclinations. And someone who studies Torah is actually above his physical inclinations and is actually free. And that would be the freedom of being involved in Torah. So when you're putting a little bit of a different spin on it, that when we can't study the Torah, God forbid, when decrees have been made, when Torah study was prohibited, so we couldn't get anything from our Rebbe, and here, on the Seder night, we act in a completely free manner, which includes, I am free to be a student. I'm free to act as a student. If my Rebbe is here, I can act as a student as well.
I was wondering if it had something to do with respect.
Well, for sure it's something to do with respect. Yes, there's no question about it. So we're going to... let's think of David HaMelech. Let's take his example over here. So we've learned over the past several months about David's ascendancy as king. And what's been happening over these past really several months of our learning Shmuel, ever since Shaul left Agag alive... So Shaul's star has been declining, and David has been rising. David was anointed immediately after Shaul sinned by leaving Agag alive. Hashem sent Shmuel to anoint David. David was anointed. We now have a funny situation of two kings. One is known, one is not known. One has authority, one doesn't have authority. But they're both anointed. They're both officially kings. Just that one has the popular vote, one doesn't. And... anyway, the whole idea of two kings doesn't make any sense. Ein shtei malachim mishtamshim bekatzarecha. Two kings can't use one crown. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. You got to have one authority. Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu when he says he's going to die, Moshe says, "Leave me alive and make Yehoshua in charge, and we'll both be in charge." He says, "No. Dabar echad ledar. Only one leader. That's it. You can't have two. There's got to be one authority. The buck stops with him." So you've got this funny situation of two kings, but as time is going on, Shaul's popularity, Shaul's authority is diminishing. David is getting more and more popular and gaining more and more authority. And eventually there will be a complete transition where David will be the king and Shaul will not.
Can I just ask a quick question? So as soon as Shaul became mentally whatever,
yeah.
Did David's mentality rise?
Yes, it says that the Ruach Ra'a beset Shaul, and the Ruach Elohim
right.
went to David. He got the Ruach Tara.
Right, okay.
So we have this situation. David, therefore, as we know, is the up-and-coming king. He's going to be the star. He's the king.
Yeah.
David has authority. As he gains more and more popularity and gains more and more authority, he is a real king. To the point where, as at a certain stage, it happened to be with Shaul's death, David transitioned to a point where he held that there is a din of Morid B'Malchus, that anybody who rebels against him needs to be put to death. That was the story with Naval. And David was correct, but Abigail stopped him to say that you should not carry that out. It's true that Naval is Chayef Misa. Naval deserves to die for having degraded David, because that you can't do to a king, and David has enough authority as a king, but David, you shouldn't be the one to kill him. Let Hashem kill him. You're not yet at a point where you should act as a king to the point where you'll kill the person who has rebelled against you. That Hashem will take care of. And she was right. But you see that David had gained his status of king, had reached a point where rebelling against him was a real rebellion. When David was first anointed, if someone would have rebelled against David, it's doubtful whether he would have been liable to be killed. Because although David was anointed, but he wasn't yet in a position of real authority. But here he is already, his star is rising. And at this point, Nabal knows what he's doing, and Nabal degrades David, and therefore Nabal is Chayav Misa. So David, in many ways, is acting as king. Remember, part of acting as king was saving this city of Keilah, where does he save them? Does he not save? The king is supposed to be the defender of the country. Does David do it or not? Remember that discussion. David is rising in that way. Yet at the same time, we find over and over again that David is unwilling to be disloyal to Hashem. And he will not kill Shaul. Shaul is the Mashiach Hashem. Shaul is the anointed one of Hashem. And David will not raise a finger against the Mashiach Hashem. He is completely loyal, completely submissive to Shaul. It comes to the point where even when Shaul eventually will be killed, David is going to put to death the person who killed Shaul. Because David says, how dare you lift a finger against the Mashiach Hashem? That's how seriously David takes it. So we pointed out in the cave, when David was unwilling to kill Shaul, and all the men said to him, Hashem has given him over into your hands. You're looking at gift horse in the mouth. How can you pass this up? And David says, no, I will not do it. We pointed out then that David was displaying his greatest midah, his greatest characteristic, which is that of complete and total loyalty to Hashem. So David is the king who has complete authority. Eventually he will have authority over the entire country. Anybody who rebels against David is liable for death. As we will see later when we get to the story of Bathsheba, her husband Uriah is going to rebel against David and will be put to death for that reason. He does deserve to be put to death for it, because he does rebel against David. We're going to see that. Others as well. And it is the correct thing to put them to death because they rebelled against David. Yet, David does not see himself as being the end-all and be-all. He is at the same time a servant. As much as he is in charge, he's also a servant. He is a servant of Hashem. David represents what it means to be submissive to Hashem, to be completely loyal to Hashem, to say that this is not about me, this is about Hashem. David represents that for us. David represents the person who says that I can have it all, I can have everything, I have access to all the money, all the creature comforts, everything that a king should have, I have. He was going to have, he's going to conquer everything, he's going to have control over everything, David. And at the same time, he will say, I am a servant of Hashem. It's what Hashem says that goes. I do whatever he tells me to do. He says X, I do X. He says Y, I do Y. He says don't do this, I don't do it. He says do that, I do that. And I am completely under his authority. Even though there's no human being who can enforce that over David. David can enforce it over everybody else, but no one else can enforce it over David. David has complete authority. He's the monarch. David at the same time represents incredible authority and incredible power and wealth, and yet complete submission to Hashem. This the quintessential servant of Hashem, the Eved. This is really what we are showing at the Seder, with this reclining. At the Seder, we have symbolism of freedom, which, as I'm showing you, is very similar to royalty. Everything is done for me. You pour the cup for me. I recline. I have my best silver and china out on the table. My best crystal out on the table. Everything is just so. We also have symbolism for slavery. So the maror is the slavery. The matzah really can be both. We discuss some of the terrible things that happened to the Jewish people. We relive the slavery. So we're doing both, because that night of Pesach we went from being slaves to being free, so we're contrasting the two. But even within the freedom, we are free to be
servants of the servants.
Right. We are free to be slaves. You follow that?
Yeah.
We started as slaves. We became free. Free to do what?
To serve.
Free to be slaves. Much of the focus of Pesach is that we learn how to be proper slaves. Not slaves to other human beings, slaves to Hashem. It's very similar to what we said before about being slaves to one's inclination. I'm a slave, as long as I'm not involved in Torah, I'm a slave to myself. I have to do whatever it is that my body demands that I do. My body says eat, I eat. My body says sleep, I sleep. My body says be lazy, I'm lazy. My body says speak Lashon Hara, I speak Lashon Hara. My body says fight, I fight. My body says get jealous, I'm jealous. My body says be resentful, I'm resentful. Right? I'm a slave to my emotions, I'm a slave to my desires, I'm a slave to my ego, I'm a slave to all that stuff. By being involved in Torah, I become free to say no to my body, to say no to my emotions, to say no to my ego. That's what I become free to do. Now, when I say no to my body, and I say no to my emotions, and I say no to my ego, and I'm becoming free, I'm saying no. Why am I saying no? Why don't I follow my body? Why don't I follow my ego? Why don't I follow my emotions? Because there's a higher authority that's telling me don't do that. There's the Torah. There's Hashem that's saying that don't follow your body, your emotions, and your ego. Don't do that. So I am free to say no to those things and be a slave to Hashem. Ultimately, we're always going to be slaves. That's the bottom line. Hashem created human beings in a way that we are always slaves. We're either slaves to other human beings, or we're slaves to ourselves, or we're slaves to Hashem. Those are the three choices. There are no other choices. You can't really be absolutely autonomous. There's no such thing, because we're created beings. And we are going to be slaves either to people, or to us, or to Hashem. The Pesach Seder, what happened in Mitzrayim was we got the freedom to become slaves to Hashem. And the Pesach Seder is all about that. So that it is absolutely appropriate, it's absolutely the same message, that when my Rebbe's not there, I am reclined and I am in comfort and I am completely relaxed as if I am on top of the world, because I'm acting like I am free, which is true. I am free of being slave to another person. Which is true. My Rebbe is here. I sit up straight. Why? Am I a slave to my Rebbe? I'm not a slave to my Rebbe. He doesn't have any power over me. He can't hurt me if I don't. If I decide not to listen to him. He can't throw me in jail. He can't fine me. So why am I sitting up straight in front of my Rebbe? Because I'm choosing. I'm choosing to show respect to my Rebbe, who for me represents the Torah, which in turn represents Hashem. That's what's happening over here. So when my Rebbe's at the Seder, I sit up perfectly straight because of respect for my Rebbe. That is freedom. That is demonstrating free to be a slave. Because I choose to accept authority. It's a funny thing. I'm going to choose to accept authority. That should be a contradiction in terms. What do you mean? If it's authority, how do you choose? Authority means you have no choice. There's someone who has authority over you. But I can choose to accept the authority. The language, make sure we don't go over time here. The language in the Mishnah is Asei Lecha Rav. Make for yourself a Rebbe. It doesn't say that the Rebbe makes you his student. It's Asei Lecha Rav. Make for yourself a Rav. We choose who's going to be our Rav. That's our choice. Everybody has the choice who you're going to make into your Rav. That's your own choice. And you choose based on what you see and what you hear and what your interactions are, etc. But you got to make him into your Rav. not into your good friend, not into your good advisor, not into a person who has some nice things to say. You make him into a Rav. What does a Rav mean? An authority figure. I make him into my authority figure. I choose to make him into an authority figure. That's the choice that comes through the freedom that Pesach is all about. See, the term slave is a very hard term to use because it has such a negative connotation.
Exactly.
But remember, we were slaves in Egypt.
Yeah.
We were absolute slaves. We had no authority. We had no autonomy whatsoever.
That's hard to
You know, so the truth is, though, that if we were really cognizant of Hashem, if we really were, we would be just as much slaves. We would just have a better owner. But we have really no... I mean, Hashem can do to us whatever He pleases. He has far more control over us than any human master ever had over his slaves.
Sure.
Right? Hashem has such control over us and knows everything about us. So we're an open book, and we're completely under His whim.
Right.
So really, the term slavery is the accurate term. But the master is a different type of master. So it's not that's really where the difference is. Human beings make very poor masters.
Yeah.
Right? Because human beings, the power corrupts. But Hashem is the perfect master. Okay. Happy and kosher. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.